e ia ka aha ho o kolo kolo kie kie hano hano ua a koa koa ho maile. This Honorable Supreme Court is reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC141030, estate of Robert Fry v. Robert P. Mastroianni, MD. Arguing for the petitioner, Anthony Rakin. Arguing for the respondent, Brad Bliss. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Rankin and Mr. Bliss. Are you both ready to proceed today?
We are.
Very well. Mr. Rankin, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Bliss, we will give you a warning at 5 minutes as well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Anthony Rankin, and I have had the honor of representing the estate of Robert Fry at all stages of this litigation, even going back before this litigation to the MCCP proceedings. And I emphasize that the MCC proceedings are not really part of the litigation, consistent with the name conciliation panel. It's an opportunity to resolve cases before litigation, and I think that's significant in the overall consideration of the issues in this case.
Do you, that's why you're on that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but do you want to explain your thinking with respect to your filing with the Medical Claims Conciliation Panel, the letter that you wrote, your thinking with respect to expression, if you intended to, of loss of a chance?
I'm not sure I understood your question, my thinking in terms of...
Well, one of the issues that's raised is whether the notice that you provided in the claim to the Medical Claims Conciliation Panel was sufficient notice that you were alleging a loss of chance. So maybe I should first ask, did you intend this to include loss of chance?
Well, it was, I think it does include loss of chance. Now, I cannot honestly reconstruct my thinking back at that time, and I don't think that's a relevant if I could reconstruct it. It's been so long, but I think the real question is, can it be interpreted to include that? And I will address that in the second portion of my argument. I want to structure it this way. I want to talk about loss of chance in the
context. Mr. Rankin, if you could maybe just pull the mic a little closer.
Sorry.
I just want to be sure that we can all hear and all not right. have to strain to hear your argument. Thank you so
I'm
much.
Sorry.
No, not at all.
So I want to talk about loss of chance in the context of causation and how the two fit together. Then I want to talk about the medical claims conciliation panel issue and how rigorous those requirements should be, and to address Justice Wilson's question of, you know, did we meet those requirements? And then I do want to address some substantial factor but for causation in the context of the evidence presented in this case. And finally, I want to mention briefly an issue that will come up if the case is remanded for retrial, and that's the question of the admissibility of a life expectancy chart.
I'm sorry, that's an issue. You didn't bring that up on the cert, did you?
In the briefing at the ICA, I brought it up. I don't recall if it's in my petition for
I think you had like 7 or 8 issues before the ICA, but you only brought 3 of them up here.
Okay. Well, if I omitted that one and if that bars this court from considering it, then so be it.
Okay, Mr. Rankin, did you bring up what Mr. Bliss terms as a problem regarding no medical records or testimony that was introduced at trial? And if so, I would like you to address that at oral argument.
Okay, I can address that. And that was not an issue that was decided by the ICA, so no, I didn't bring it up on cert.
Okay.
And in fact, actually, Justice McKenna, the issue of the life expectancy chart, as I recall, was not addressed either by the ICA. So this would be the first court to consider now. Forgive me.
So you're asking us to consider the issues that the ICA did not need to consider based on its ruling?
Yes, because if you remand,
it affirmed the dismissal.
Come back to the trial
right.
court. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So there's a fine line, if any line, between substantial factor causation and loss of chance. Loss of chance doctrine, I would submit, is actually subsumed in the law of causation, especially in a death case. To illustrate, what is the difference between these two cases? One, the patient seeks treatment of a serious condition where the risk of death with proper treatment is small. The physician is negligent and the patient dies. Two, patient seeks treatment of a serious condition where there is a not insubstantial risk of death, even with proper treatment. The physician is negligent and the patient dies. The difference is that the estate of the patient in the first case can probably find an expert willing to opine that the chances of survival for that patient were greater than 51% with proper care, and or that the physician's negligence was a but-for cause of death, and or that there was a probability of survival with proper treatment. And the estate of the patient in the latter case, too, where there's a substantial risk of death even with proper treatment, may not be able to find such an expert.
Do you have to prove that in a typical wrongful death case or something that the plaintiff has to prove that the person would have survived? Is that part of causation? The ICA concludes that, it seems to me, but is that part of our law?
No, I don't believe so. The ICA.
What would have precluded a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim?
What would have precluded a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim?
Without death. How can a reasonable person, normally constituted, be able to deal with the thought that my life may have been shortened?
Well, in this
by
case,
failure, my physician's failure to meet the standard of care.
In this case,
I know you didn't allege it, but I'm just saying, why do we have to go to a loss of chance when we have such an expansive NIED law here?
He did not, he was not in good condition when he returned to the hospital the second.
And he probably, I'm not sure if he was even conscious.
Really out.
Right, right. So. And in terms of the surviving family members, I think we have case law that may have restricted their potential recovery here because they were not in Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
But putting aside that, in general, loss of chance, it seems loss of chance is kind of vague. Different jurisdictions rule on it differently. And as Justice Pollack says, do you really need that doctrine here in Hawaii?
I don't know that we really do, and that's what I'm addressing. Let me continue.
Aren't there a couple jurisdictions I think have been cited that encompass loss of chance within their substantial factor? Why isn't it part of our law already?
It is part. If you'll indulge me, it'd be more efficient if I kind of read this prepared remarks that really just goes right to the heart of that question. The ICA assumed this type of causation evidence, a chance of survival greater than 50%, but for cause, a probability of survival was required, and that since it was lacking in our case, plaintiff could only recover if the court were to recognize a separate cause of action. However, this court has not required that sort of proof of causation. It refused to require but-for causation or proximate cause. It leaves it to the jury to decide whether something is a substantial factor, i.e. a legal cause, and it clearly instructs the jury there can be more than one substantial factor. There is no need for a separate loss of chance theory of recovery in cases involving wrongful death because Hawaii's law of legal cause is flexible enough to allow for recovery in the appropriate case without requiring the patient's estate to establish that the patient would have survived in the absence.
Mr. Rankin, can I just say, that's the position you're advocating for now. I'm trying to understand. You were just reading the position you have. Did I misunderstand? Was there a loss of chance that was somehow pled in the complaint or suggested in the complaint, or is that not an accurate?
It was, yes.
So are you abandoning that position or suggesting that it was misconstrued? Or
We're throwing everything at the ball and seeing what will stick, as a good litigator should do. And we did certainly allege that, but we're saying there's no need to even hang your hat on that or hang your robe on that hook, because we do have a substantial factor test, which we certainly have met in this case.
Just to, I th- complete your point. I think clearly then you're saying that it's not necessary to determine that this is a separate cause of action. It's just an analysis that goes into whether this was a substantial factor in the cause of the injury.
Yes, that's one way of viewing it, or you can treat it as a not necessarily a separate cause of action, but more a theory of causation, or even really a theory of damage is how I view it as well. The ICA acknowledged in its opinion that some courts do address loss of chance, loss of a chance that could not be quantified as over 50% with what the ICA called relaxed causation. But what the ICA failed to recognize was that Hawaii's law of causation is completely already in line with these authorities. The ICA's decision in the Torres case, which was briefed by Michi Curiae, is a good example. The decedent was operating a front-end loader that tipped off the ground, failed to stabilize, and fell on top of him. He alleged that defendant was negligent in not providing wider treads, which could have allowed the vehicle to stabilize after the initial tilt and prevented it from falling. Plaintiff's expert said it was possible or likely that wider tracks would have prevented the fall. The jury found for the plaintiff, but the trial court directed a verdict for the defendant on the ground that it was not enough to show defendant had possibly caused the injuries, and alternative explanations had not been disproven. But the ICA reversed, saying substantial factor was the appropriate test of causation. Now, this case is just like that Torres case. Plaintiff's expert explained how timely care would have raised Fry's chances of survival. The trial court demanded that the expert testify to a probability of survival, not a possibility. So, in effect, it required plaintiff to disprove the alternative explanation for his death, that the infection would have killed him even with timely treatment.
Mr. Rankin, may I ask you, when an expert testifies and relies on information regarding the, in this case, Mr. Fry, is that information that the expert relied on admitted into evidence substantively, or is it admitted in evidence at all, or is it just a basis for the expert's testimony?
Okay, I can only, and this is the same question you did ask me at the start, which I do want to address. In this, I can only address what happened in this case.
Well, because Mr. Bliss is arguing that we can affirm the ICA on other grounds.
Yes, and he did not raise that. He and his co-counsel at trial did not raise that issue at all at trial. It was not part of their Rule 50 motion. And I would submit that because they did not raise it, they cannot raise that on appeal, and the court should not reach that issue. Even if the court were to reach that issue, not raise it all in the trial court, let me first say, you know, there's one important reason in this case, practical reason, why that should preclude appellate review, is that if it had been raised, I could have moved the court to reopen my case if that was, if I analyzed that and felt, okay, yes, we should have something besides the experts testifying to what happened. And the judge could have, in her discretion, allowed me to call the custodian of records from Mount Memorial Hospital and throw those records into evidence. But it was not necessary in any case, because my answer to your question is, under the very circumstance in this case, the specific testimony given by the witnesses was not just my opinion of such and such. It was a detailed description of their review of the records and what happened. And there was no objection on hearsay grounds to that testimony, no objection on any grounds to most of it. It was allowed as substantive evidence with no limiting instruction, and therefore we were entitled to rely on that evidence. The ICA, as I was saying in the Torres case, or in this case, I'm sorry, imposed a greater burden of proof of causation on patients who are injured by malpractice when seeking medical care for a serious condition than it did in other cases like the more garden variety accident of Torres. It wrongly concluded that the requirement of expert opinion on causation, which must be rendered to a reasonable medical probability, means that the expert must opine that the patient had a probability of survival with proper care. but that is not the law. Hawaii courts require medical opinions to be offered based on reasonable medical probability in all areas of their testimony, not just causation. It is required because possibilities are endless in the field of medicine, as the court stated. That doesn't speak to substantive requirements for any elements of causation. It just speaks to the degree of certainty with which testimony must be given. The ICA's confusion on that is like the confusion of the Massachusetts court in Matsuyama, which says that because a plaintiff must establish its case by a preponderance of the evidence, it must show defendant's negligence was the preponderant cause of death, but that does not follow. There are a whole bunch of reasons why imposing a higher standard on people facing a serious medical condition is a bad idea, particularly because statistics and probabilities are inherently problematic when survival is expressed as a percentage, and that's only a rough approximation anyway.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
sure.
Since you're on your description of the testimony of the experts, Mr. Rankin,
yes.
You have three experts testifying, all to testimony in which they say they reached to a reasonable medical probability. And what is your view about then what it was that they were opining about to a reasonable medical probability? Is it your view that the evidence that they provided was not sufficient for a jury to find that the negligence caused the death?
On the contrary, I think it was. And let me address exactly what, two of them, I'll acknowledge that it was weak on that. But Dr. Smith testified, the measures that the hospital would have taken if not for the negligent premature discharge, those measures, in quotes, would all ensure his safety, end quote. The hospital care would have ensured Robert Fry's safety. Could not a reasonable juror interpret that to mean would have allowed Robert Fry to live?
But, and that, was that addressed by the ICA?
Yes.
Did the ICA address the testimony of Dr. Smith?
No, not at all. Both the trial court and the IC completely skirted any analysis of his testimony. And not only did Dr. Smith say that the measures would have ensured his safety, he also said if Robert had remained in the hospital, he, quote, again, exact quote, would have fared much better, end quote. Now, maybe Dr. Smith's phraseology was a little too poetic or not blunt enough for the trial judge's taste, but a reasonable juror, I would submit, could find that what it means when Dr. Smith says it would have ensured his safety and that he would have fared much better if kept in the hospital, a reasonable juror could find that would have fared much better means that he probably wouldn't have died. I don't think Dr. Smith was just saying that with hospital care he would have lived an hour or two longer, right? That's not very much better than dying in these circumstances. This court's ruling in the Takayama case quoted at the bottom of page 9 of the ICA's opinion actually states the four requirements to prevail in a negligence claim. One is a duty. Two is a failure on the defendant's part to conform to the duty, a breach of the duty. Those aren't an issue here. Three is a reasonably close causal connection between the conduct and the resulting injury. And four is actual loss or damage resulting to the interest of another. So the reasonably close causal connection between the conduct and the injury, the way this court has phrased it in that seminal case is instructive here. And to continue addressing Justice Wilson's question about the proof at trial, I'm going to read to you just two sentences or three from my brief because I can't say it any better. A primary role of the expert witness is to educate the jury so that they can fairly evaluate the evidence. In this case, the experts educated the jury at length as to what would be done in the hospital if he had not been negligently discharged, and why and what effects it would have. The trial court should leave it to a jury to hear and evaluate all the evidence and the opinions of the expert witnesses and the detailed bases for those opinions, and then the jury determines if the testimony as a whole, and a lot of it's not discussed here because it's a complete picture we were painting at trial, determine if the testimony as a whole leaves them with the belief that the hospital discharge was a substantial factor leading to Mr. Fry's untimely death. Now, we did, like I say, present a complete and detailed picture of the medical evidence, and our experts fulfilled their proper role of educating the jury. If you look at the 701 to 3 series of Hawaii Rules of Evidence, that's their role. So they did that so the jury could decide whether the doctor committed a medical error and whether that error was a substantial factor in Robert Fry's death. My expert witnesses gave their opinions, but they didn't do it in a heavy-handed way. They showed respect for the jury's role by educating the jury, giving the jury the facts, and then letting the jury draw the ultimate conclusion.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as far as the jury reaching the ultimate conclusion, what was your intent with respect to jury instructions on loss of a chance? How would you have had the jury instructed as to how to view the expert's testimony with regard to the concept of loss of a chance?
I probably had the jury instructions. I'm sure I did have them drafted. I didn't bring them with me, but I believe it, in keeping with the precedents from other jurisdictions, would have said that the doctor's negligence deprived the plaintiff substantially reduced his chances of survival, something along those lines. The McBride case is probably, from the Ninth Circuit, is probably the most conservative view of that. Other cases from other jurisdictions have not even held such a high standard, but the McBride case, I think, references, okay, you know, if he would have had a 30% chance of survival and it goes down to 15%, then that's a substantial reduction in his chances. But they didn't say it has to be done.
I'm sorry, what did you say McBride said?
I think that was the case where they said, you know, that if it's comes down from, it's in my brief, if it's not the McBride, but if the chances are reduced from, say, if he'd been left in the hospital, he still would have had only a 30% chance of survival, say. But because he was sent home from the hospital by the defendant in this case, his chances of surviving the illness went down to 15%. That's a substantial reduction in his chances of survival. But the McBride case did not put any, you know, specific, it's got to be so many.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to look at McBride again. I didn't notice them talking about 15 to 30%.
For my rebuttal argument, I'll try to find where that is. It could be my mistake that it's not actually the McBride case, but another. But I'll find where I was reading that in my preparation.
But so just to summarize, that would be the instruction you would say the jury should receive? The question was, how should the jury be instructed if we do send this case back for a new trial?
Gosh, there are. You know, I apologize for not being prepared to give you a specific.
Oh, no. Why not just summarize your position? Because, you know, I've heard, you know, it's a damages, it goes to damages, goes to causation. It's not really a separate theory. What, in substance, would you ask or suggest the jury should be instructed?
I'm just going to say if it does come to loss of chance rather than just substantial factor, and I would have, you know, asked for both kinds of instructions to cover the bases, then I would say substantially reduced the plaintiff's chances of survival, the patient's chances of survival.
Well, Mr. Rankin, are you saying loss of chance is a doctrine that I think that's what you argued is covered by and is part of causation for wrongful death, or are you saying, you know, the ICA said it stands alone as a separate cause of action? So which do you?
I do not believe it's a separate cause of action. I think it's a part of, it's a theory of causation and really a theory of damages. Let me finally, I have just 7 minutes left or so I want to address the MCCP. I think that's important, the question of, you know, Let's see. Well, I think that question is kind of raised in the MCCP, whether loss of chance is a separate claim like negligence or lack of informed consent. And I think the answer is it's not. The consequence is the element of damages. And in the MCCP, fairness is the goal. So is there really a difference between someone getting ill and the doctor committing negligence and the person dying as a result? And someone getting ill and the doctor committing negligence and the person losing the opportunity that he had to recover and keep living. From the point of view of a doctor defending an MCCP case, or we don't even call it defending, appearing before the MCCP, that's not a significant difference in terms of how that doctor would defend it. And since the MCCP decision is not binding, it's not important that the plaintiff refine it to that degree. You know, the point of MCCP is very similar to the CAP program, which is a very effective program. It gets the parties together, they hear each other, they get some input from a neutral third party, and as a result, maybe they avoid litigation. If it's done in an early stage, well, it is done in an early stage before discovery, in other words, before the parties have a chance to, fully refine their case and understand all the nuances, and it's done to avoid the cost and the time and the burdens of protracted litigation. And in this case, it functioned as intended. The doctor on the panel put up the x-rays on his computer monitor and showed everyone, what to look for and how he interpreted that. He had a heart-to-heart with the doctor, the defendant, and talked about how mistakes happen. It's tough to acknowledge, but at the end, it's not the end of the world or his career. We move on. They even recommended a settlement of between 100 and 300,000, very conservative. My client was actually.
Are you talking about settlement discussions here?
No, I'm talking about the MCCP and how it functions.
How it functions. Okay.
I won't go on at that point, but my point is, and I didn't mean to, I'm sorry, step over any line. This is just oral argument. But the point is, it's a good exercise. It could and should have worked in this case. And that's because it was a full airing of the relevant facts and circumstances, and everyone present understood the case very well. The doctor in this case is now trying to say to us this whole litigation is invalid because at the MCCP we said that he was we used language that wasn't sufficiently clear, I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but.
Well, let me ask you about your language, because I think you're in the course of discussing whether or not the claim that you filed sufficiently addressed loss of a chance. And your second to last paragraph says, with the benefit of closer observation and care, it is likely that he would have survived. You didn't say he would have survived. You said it is likely that he would have survived. So how, if at all, does that relate to loss of a chance?
It doesn't. That's not specific loss of chance language, although we did amplify, as I pointed out in my brief, in the statements of the expert reports that were submitted, we included language that was much more loss of chance. But I think the difference from the point of view of a doctor hearing that is really quibbling to say that, we didn't put them on sufficient notice. The MCCP is not to put them, to cover in that level of detail. And the exercise of determining the patient's exact chances of survival had the negligence not occurred is not very relevant from the point of view of the doctor at that proceeding, which is basically to determine if you fell below the standard of care.
Mr. Rankin, anything else at this point on this issue?
Let me just skip the rest of it and say
I'm not trying to rush you, although you're.
But I am running out of time, and let me say that the life expectancy chart. I would like the court to review that issue. The judge, we took the very routine step at trial of asking for judicial notice of the life expectancy based on the published chart. The judge denied that.
She ruled. Oh, I'm sure we can find in the record what she ruled.
On page 32, I quote, she said, we have to prove that he would have been in that category of lived that long, and I submit that she got it backwards. The chart's admissible, and then it's up to the defendant to say that the defendant's, that the decedent's state of health was such that he would not be in conformance with that chart.
Very well. Anything further at this point, Mr. Rankin?
I've got 1 minute reserved for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Bliss.
May it please the court. I'm Brad Bliss, and I'm here representing the defendant, appellee, respondent, Dr. Robert Mastroianni. The two primary bases upon which the Intermediate Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment as a matter of law in favor of Dr. Mastroianni were that the plaintiff had failed to present a loss of chance theory at the MCCP proceeding, and therefore the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction over any such claim to consider as a basis for allowing the case to move forward. Secondly, and independently of that jurisdictional finding by the trial court, it also found that the plaintiff had failed to present adequate expert testimony to a reasonable degree of medical probability to establish that there was any causal connection between the medical care provided by Dr. Mastroianni and Mr. Fry's death.
What about Dr. Smith's testimony that if the steps that he had testified to had been taken, it would have ensured Mr. Fry's safety?
I would point out that that's fairly vague.
Reasonable, but he testified to that to a reasonable degree of medical probability.
That it would have
ensured his safety.
Ensured his safety.
Doesn't that suggest that perhaps he might have lived?
Might have. Might have lived. That's the key.
It thing. Would have ensured his safety. And, you know, let's go back to Zurich versus Tamura. Zurich versus Tamura, 1960. This is a case we keep using. Justice Lewis said, when causation of the injury is a medical issue, as it is here, the matter does not turn on the use of a particular form of words by the physicians in giving their testimony, since it is for the trier of facts, not the medical witnesses, to make a legal determination of the question of causation. You know, we're not here on an appeal after a jury verdict. This is a motion for judgment as a matter of law, which you only get if, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, there's no evidence whatsoever to support the plaintiff's theory. How can you argue that this testimony is no evidence?
I don't think it's our position that it's no evidence. It is our position that it is not sufficient evidence.
No, but this test is no evidence for motions for judgment as a matter of law. This is not contesting a jury verdict of liability. You don't get judgment as a matter of law unless there's no evidence.
I think this brings us full circle to the issue of the loss of chance doctrine. This case was pled solely as a wrongful death claim. That's our position.
Wrongful death and survival. Why are the survivors plaintiffs if there's not a survival claim?
Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that at the point in time when this case went to trial, a number of the original plaintiffs, the survivors, were no longer plaintiffs in this case. Their claims had been dismissed. That issue is not before this court. The dismissal of those claims was not appealed. The only party plaintiff at the time of trial was the estate of Robert Fry.
Okay. All right.
And so I think that's an important point. We've heard plaintiff's counsel allude to the fact that he views loss of chance as perhaps the damages theory. Well, some courts across the country do view it in that respect. However, it's critically important to bear in mind that because the only plaintiff in this case at trial was the estate of Robert Fry, Hawaii's wrongful death statute strictly limits the damages that could be recovered on behalf of the plaintiff in this case. Specifically, HRS 663-3 states that the legal representative may recover on behalf of the estate the reasonable expenses of the deceased's last illness and burial, period. Those are the only damages that are at issue in this case.
Oh, that is, you're going to argue that he doesn't get, the estate doesn't get his pain and suffering, his loss of excess earnings?
The estate could present a claim for those. I don't believe, again, that there was any evidence presented for loss of earnings in this particular case. In fact, I'm fairly certain no evidence whatsoever of a
loss of enjoyment of life?
That claim could have been presented on behalf of the estate.
Isn't that what the life expectancy chart was about?
No, I think the life expectancy chart went to how much longer he might have lived if he had survived.
Doesn't that go to damages for loss of enjoyment of life, which is a typical part of a wrongful death claim?
Only if he establishes causation and basis to recover on a wrongful death claim in the first instance, which we believe he did not in this case. And with respect to the expert testimony that was presented, what I heard just earlier this morning from plaintiff's counsel is that he frankly admitted that two out of three of his medical experts were, to use his term, weak. They didn't provide adequate testimony. And then he said, but Dr. Smith.
So it's your argument. I mean, we're getting back to what Justice McKenna initially indicated about the no evidence standard. What you're saying is that because two of the doctors may not have been as strong as Dr. Smith, that therefore the court was appropriately granted the motion. I mean, that's not consistent with our law.
No, that's not
but
quite my argument.
I thought your argument was it was so weak it couldn't qualify as proof. But Dr. Schultz and Dr. Jacobs both said that the standard of care in this community wasn't met. I suppose maybe you could say that their basis for concluding that was a bit weak, but it would seem that once they state to a reasonable medical probability that the standard of care hasn't been met, you could get past the threshold of the judge taking the expert testimony away from the jury and let it go to the jury, because they did add some facts to that. They spoke about misdiagnosis, for example, both of them, and they also both spoke about the need to have the decedent in the hospital longer. So I suppose you could say that it was weak, but I'm not sure you could say that it was testimony that ended up having no probative value.
I wouldn't say it had no probative value. And when
if it has probative value, why wouldn't it go to the jury?
Well,
if it's spoken of, and they were specific that they were making their opinions to a reasonable medical probability, so why wouldn't that go to the jury?
For this reason, they didn't meet the proximate cause standard of connecting their belief that Dr. Mastroianni's care did not meet the standard of care
to his
death. Do we still
use proximate cause?
I'm sorry?
Do we still use proximate cause? I thought we switched to substantial factor and legal cause.
I wasn't meaning to state a different standard or to use the incorrect or inappropriate terminology. However we phrase it, substantial cause,
substantial factor.
Cause, substantial
okay.
factor, it was not met here. And the evidence...
And how do you argue that Dr. Smith's testimony does not go to substantial factor?
It goes to it. It just doesn't... It's not sufficient.
Can I just read it?
Connection.
But being in a hospital under close observation, such that those steps could have been taken, if indicated, would all ensure his safety. Why does that not, in your view, create at least an issue for the jury?
Because it's too broad and not specific to the facts in this case. That statement that retrospectively, if the patient had only remained in the hospital, I would submit would fit virtually every single case where a patient is discharged and sometime thereafter has complications and, as happened in this case, passes away. One can always look back retrospectively and say, gee, if only they had been in the hospital.
But that's not this case. This case has a context. It has facts, right? He threw up. He had there was evidence that he actually had pneumonia. I mean, it's not as though he was just in the hospital and then released early without any analysis as to the cause of his injury.
That's true. And certainly the experts in this case can and did disagree about whether it was appropriate to for Dr. Mastroianni to discharge Mr. Fry when he did. But the point I was making is simply that this kind of vague testimony by the expert that plaintiff has relied on primarily, Dr. Smith, to say it would have ensured his safety. Sure, you're always better off if you're in the hospital and can get immediate medical care for any complication or medical problem you may have. That's not enough. It doesn't meet the substantial factor test of connecting the care provided by Dr. Mastroianni, the decision to discharge Mr. Fry when he did, with his death.
But that would be true if there was no evidence going to the standard of care having been met or not met by this physician, and didn't Dr. Smith identify ways in which, in his opinion, the standard of care was not met? So, yes, in some abstract sense, you like to think you're always better off in a hospital, but that's not what he went further and said there are very specific things that weren't done that should have been done, in his view, and had they been done, it would have ensured his safety. Why isn't that enough? I understand you're concerned about the broader issue, but actually looking at his testimony here.
I think again, we get back to this phrase, would have ensured his safety. What does that mean? Is it really a substantial factor in whether he certainly did not say, and this was noted, I think, by both the trial court and the intermediate court, he did not say, if only Mr. Fry had never been discharged, he would have survived. He would have lived.
Is that a requirement under our law?
I would submit that
a wrongful death?
Not necessarily a requirement per se, but under the facts of this case, I think it was incumbent on the plaintiff's experts to be able to say to a reasonable degree of medical probability that, yes, he would have survived.
So under this case, you're saying that that's why the court decision, so it's kind of like a new rule of law that when we have facts like this, there has to be such testimony?
Well, each case turns on its own facts, and each case is unique. I don't know that it sets a standard particularly, but under the facts in this case, I think it was incumbent on the plaintiff's experts, since this was a wrongful death case, that they be able to come in and testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability that if Dr. Mastroianni had done certain things and if he had not discharged Mr. Fry when he did, that yes, he would have survived. I think that's the only way you get to
proving that
he was responsible for Mr. Fry's death.
It sounds like a but-for standard, which this court has rejected for, I think, more than 50 years.
Well, I don't think it necessarily is a but-for standard. However, all of the expert testimony presented was meticulously reviewed by both the trial court and the ICA. I was surprised to hear plaintiff's counsel say that he didn't think the ICA considered Dr. Smith's testimony. They quoted Dr. Smith's testimony at length.
Well, they mentioned certain things that he said, but they didn't mention, I don't think, the testimony about ensuring his safety. Instead, they pointed to something about there would be an advantage. That was one portion that they mentioned.
Again, kind of a vague phrase that doesn't really get to the heart of the matter, I think. And I think it's also important to bear in mind there was a statement made by Mr. Rankin to the effect that, well, these experts testified on behalf of the plaintiff, and there was no objection whatsoever to the admission of these experts' testimony. That is plainly not correct. These experts for the plaintiff, with one exception, Dr. Schultz, their testimony was presented by deposition, and it was the subject of extensive motion practice through motions in limine to say they cannot testify to this, this, and this. Certain testimony by the experts was excluded. So it's not as though we didn't object to some of the evidence that he attempted to put in by these experts, and they can't use that to bootstrap the lack of medical records.
Along those lines, you know, one of the issues that's being raised is this life expectancy table. And if this court were to remand for a new trial, they're asking, plaintiffs are asking that we address the remaining four issues raised on appeal. What is the defense's position with respect to that?
Our position is that the ICA addressed those issues and said they did not need to consider them. And when application for certiorari was made to this court, those issues were not raised. So I don't think that the life expectancy table or any of the other issues that...
So you're saying we need to remand? If there was a new trial ordered, it would have to be remanded back to the ICA to address those issues?
Well,
By the way, why did it take 7 years for this case to get to trial? Mr. Fry died in 2004. It's been 15 years since he died.
Right. I'm struggling to remember. I worked on the case throughout that time period. I can't speak to all of the reasons it took that long. It was an extended period between when the case was filed and when it finally proceeded to trial. There were a number of motions filed to dismiss the individual plaintiffs as parties, which were granted.
I'm just curious, did you argue that if you're not a radiologist, you can't testify as to radiological opinions, like you can't testify as to x-rays if you're not a radiologist yourself? That seems to have been one of the rulings.
We did argue that, and I can't recall specifically which of the plaintiff's experts it was who was opining to radiological opinions. We did make that argument, and the trial court ruled in our favor in that respect. I don't think it was quite as simple as saying, if you're not a radiologist, you can't opine as to any opinion on radiology. It went more to the level of detail that this particular expert was attempting to express based on his review of x-rays. We did not feel it was appropriate, and the trial court agreed.
Could you address the loss of chance doctrine and the defense's position with regard to, is that a separate cause of action? Is it a reduced causation standard? And how should the jury be instructed on that doctrine if we were to determine that it is properly in play in this case and we were to send the case back?
Well, of course, it's our position that the loss of chance should not be recognized even as the ICA did in this instance, because it's a theory that's fraught with many issues and problems. But to specifically address your question, I think that it is more appropriately deemed a separate cause of action that must be specifically pled as such, rather than a theory of causation or a more relaxed causation standard or a theory of damages. And that is how the Intermediate Court of Appeals recognized this loss of chance doctrine in its opinion. And I think it was very careful to limit it to the facts in this case and to point out that it does view it as a separate cause of action. The court didn't have jurisdiction in this case because it was not brought before the MCCP, and it would be a theory going forward that would only apply in wrongful death cases.
I'm still reaching for your position as to why it's preferable to be a separate cause of action as opposed to consider it in terms of whether the substantial factor was a represented by the loss of chance. Why not relate it just to the question of whether the negligence was a substantial factor?
Because I think we don't need loss of chance to address substantial factor, and substantial factor being the standard to determine if alleged medical negligence was a substantial factor in the outcome.
If you recognize that cause of action, don't you have to make that analysis anyways as to whether or not there it was a substantial factor, negligence was a substantial factor in the loss of chance?
You definitely have to make the analysis as to whether the negligence was a substantial factor in the outcome. But the difference with recognizing loss of chance as a causation doctrine is it gets into this kind of slippery slope where you've got experts coming in and saying, oh, you know, if only the physician had done X, Y, and Z, yeah, we think there was a better chance. Well, would the patient have survived? If, no, but a better chance, you know, and then
sure,
how do you value that?
Sure, I'm following you with respect to that idea that the idea of proof becomes perhaps more awkward, or as you say, there's a slippery slope. But isn't that an argument for not recognizing the doctrine of loss of chance, as opposed to if it's going to be recognized, whether it should be as a cause of action or as an aspect of damages?
I think it's definitely an argument for not recognizing it in any form. Mm-hmm. I would agree with that, and that is our position before this court. However, if it were to be recognized, it's so much cleaner, I think, if it's recognized as a separate cause of action versus a relaxed theory of causation. And I think one only needs to look at how this has been applied in other jurisdictions and the various damages calculations that some courts have recognized or opined as appropriate to know that it's problematic to allow loss of chance to be recognized as a separate claim, and to put a dollar figure on that is extremely problematic, both in terms of the proof and how you measure the damages. And I think for those reasons, it should not be recognized.
CJ.
What's your response to the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which talked about a case in which the plaintiff's decedent had a misdiagnosis for cancer at the time. According to the jury, at the time that misdiagnosis occurred, there was only something less than a 50% chance of survival. Yet the jury concluded that there had been a misdiagnosis, and that there had been, or in fact, I think they basically looked at the full amount of damages and reduced it by the amount of the chance that they thought had been taken away. What's your response to that kind of situation, and how should that be handled?
I believe you're referring to the Matsuyama
case. I think, yeah.
Well, what I found interesting in that case, and it gets back to a point I was just making, within that case, after they decided to recognize loss of chance in that jurisdiction in the first instance, they went into what they believed was the appropriate damages determination, and this is on page 840 of the Massachusetts Supreme Court's opinion. It's a five-step process. It's very odd. First, the fact finder must calculate total damages allowable under the wrongful death statute. Next, the fact finder must calculate the patient's chance of survival preceding but for the medical malpractice. Third, the fact finder must then calculate the chance of survival or cure that the patient had as a result of the medical malpractice. Fourth, the fact finder must then subtract the amount derived in step three from the amount derived in step two. Fifth, the fact finder must then multiply the amount determined in step one by the percentage calculated in step four to derive the proportional damages award for loss of chance. That's an incredibly convoluted calculation that I don't think any jury could reasonably attempt to follow or apply, and it shows the problems with recognizing loss of chance.
Of course, the situation there actually were probabilities that were in the record. So the physicians there had given statistical probabilities because there was stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, and for each stage apparently there are medically determined probabilities, or that at least were accepted in the record. So, but your suggestion is, absent that kind of evidence, that this wouldn't be workable?
Exactly. And I think this case, the Fry case, is a good example of one in which loss of chance should not be recognized or applied, because it really has no clear basis to instruct the jury on how they should determine percentages of liability or percentages of damages or the ultimate damage award.
Now, if we were to recognize the loss of chance, what's your response to the, or your position is it wasn't adequately raised in the MCCP. What's your response to Mr. Rankin's argument that that's a degree of formalism that's not required by the applicable statute?
Well, first I would point out that I don't think the ICA, in its opinion, was intending to state some explicit pleading requirement under the MCCP. It was looking squarely at the facts of this case and as it was presented there.
But isn't that because, I mean, that statute's been completely, or not completely, substantially revamped. So when you say they're not making some, I think they would be making some broad statement, but for the fact that that statute's language has been amended.
The statute has been amended, that's true. At the time of this case, it was the Medical Claims Conciliation Panel. It is now the Medical Inquiry Conciliation Panel. But I believe the language in terms of what needs to be presented, or certainly the jurisdictional requirement of presenting a claim and presenting it clearly and explicitly at the time of the MCCP or MICP, is still there. And so that...
Could I ask you this about specifically the language in this claim and how you feel it's inadequate? Because at the beginning of the claim that was filed by Mr. Rankin in this June 9th, 2006 claim, says that it hereby present a claim for damage resulting from Mr. Robert Frey's death. But in the second to last paragraph, in this language that I'd read earlier, it says, with the benefit of closer observation and care, it is likely that he would have survived. So there, in that sentence, there isn't a claim that he would have survived. It just says he's likely that he would have survived. Now, you are taking the position that that can't be interpreted as loss of a chance.
Correct.
So I just wanted to understand why. Did you think that in order for there to be a sufficient description of the claim, it has to use the words loss of a chance?
That would be one way. I think that it's important to point out that this is clearly being presented as a wrongful death claim.
Actually, the words wrongful death aren't in the claim either, right? And it's, but I agree with you. It's clear it's a wrongful death claim, but the words wrongful death aren't in here. So why can't the it be inferred that the loss of chance was also included in this?
I don't think the language is explicit enough, and if we compare the language in this letter to the complaint, it's a stark difference. Because
I think you just sort of, in a sense, said, when you said it's not explicit enough, you know, it seems to me that there is an interpretation of this statute that's far more rigorous than how we interpret claims under our rules of civil procedure. And I don't see how that can be countenanced when this is supposed to be a conciliation claims panel, and we're coming up with a standard that is more strict. And our court has said many times that the pleading rules are not meant to be a game of skill where one misstep would be decisive. What it seems to me the ICA ruling can be certainly be read to be exactly what has occurred. That's what we would never do with a claim in our courts.
I think the critical distinction is this is not an issue of, well, did we have sufficient notice, or were we somehow prejudiced because it wasn't stated with enough clarity at that stage. This is a jurisdictional requirement imposed by the statute that says before you can even get to this point of pleading it in a court of law, you have to come before us and you have to clearly tell us what the claim is, clearly tell the respondent what your claim is and what it's based on.
But all the facts were there. The facts were all there.
The facts are there, but one could say the same thing about, for example, a claim for lack of informed consent, which our appellate courts have held, if it's not explicitly pled or brought at the MCCP or MICP stage, you're out of luck after that.
And isn't there a basis?
You're all there for that claim as well, but if you don't present it, you are not allowed to proceed forward because it's a jurisdictional prerequisite.
Isn't there a basis in the statute for that? Isn't there a, doesn't the statute, I don't have, I'm sorry, I don't have the statute right in front of me, but isn't there a recognition in the statute of informed consent versus actual negligence?
Or if I that's, believe there is, yes. So. I think it's called out distinctively there.
And in fact, following up on the Chief Justice question, at the time the statute said any person or the person's representative claiming that a medical tort has been committed, and then medical tort is defined in 671.1 as professional negligence, rendering of professional services without informed consent, or an omission in professional practice. So this clearly came, the allegations in this case clearly comes in with the medical tort definitional requirement.
Well, I would respectfully disagree that they sufficiently pled it. Trial court agreed with that position. Obviously, the Intermediate Court of Appeals did as well. I would urge this court to find similarly and to affirm the judgment in favor of Dr. Mastroianni, and once again point out that there is an independent basis for affirming that judgment.
I know your time's about up, but I did want to give you a chance if you wanted to respond to McBride. Are you suggesting that we reject the analysis of McBride, which concerned, as you know, the chance of survival if the decedent was taken to the hospital and therefore his chances of having a heart attack would have been lessened? And there was even expert testimony as to the percentage to which there would have been a loss of chance.
I think I would say that it doesn't have to be recognized as the ICA did as a separate cause of action, and that under the appropriate facts or circumstances, it may be an argument that can be presented that there is a causal connection between the alleged negligence and the outcome, death in that case and in our case, but it's not necessary to treat it as a separate cause of action.
Actually, in McBride, there was evidence. One of the physicians testified that the decedent's chances of living would have improved at least 50% by being admitted to the hospital. And that is the testimony that Judge Pence found met the reasonable medical probability that the treatment would have successfully prevented the patient's injury. So it appears that this is really a substantial factor analysis, not a loss of chance analysis.
I would agree.
Because if the decedent had been admitted, he likely would have survived.
And in the appropriate case.
And how does that differ from this case? We have testimony that his safety would have been ensured if he had been properly diagnosed and given the proper medication.
I think by exactly the language you've just referenced, to say his safety would have been ensured versus experts opining that there was a greater than 50% chance this patient would have survived, there's a pretty clear distinction there, and I think that's the difference.
You wouldn't have objected to that testimony from the expert if the expert in this case had said, if Dr. Smith said there was a greater than 50% chance he would have survived?
I suspect we would have very much objected to that testimony as not having sufficient basis in the facts and standards for expert testimony at trial. So
McBride should not be taken as authority by this court?
No.
Because that's what happened in McBride, right? You had an expert testify to that effect.
Each case is unique on its facts, and perhaps in that case, in the McBride case, it was appropriate, and the expert felt that the facts were sufficient to put an actual percentage or number on it. The experts in this case did not do that, and it would not have been appropriate for them to do so.
I see. Your objection would have been based on the fact there isn't sufficient evidence to quantify by putting a certain percentage on the chances of survival.
Correct.
For Mr. Bliss, anything further in summary for this court at this time?
only to point out, as I did in our brief, that there are multiple grounds on which this court can affirm the judgment in favor of Dr. Mastroianni, and we would urge the court to do so.
Very well. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Rankin, your rebuttal. And
yes, thank you. We sued for wrongful death and negligence, too. That includes loss of enjoyment of the rest of what would have been Robert Fry's life, and evidence was presented of those damages. On the McBride case, I would ask the court to just jot down the bottom of page 17 of our opening brief, footnote 4 in particular, contains an analysis. I think it's been a misstatement from that we've heard here from a couple of participants that McBride found he had, you know, would have survived more likely than not, over 50% chance. McBride was referring to the difference between the survival odds before and after the doctor's negligence, and that's significant. And I do, Justice McKenna, I do get into the 15% and 30% in that footnote 4 at the bottom of page 17. Finally, when I referred to some of my expert witnesses' testimony as weak in one respect, I was only talking about on the subject of causation of death. I think they were strong on other issues, including medical negligence, but they didn't go as far as Dr. Smith on the subject of whether that caused the death or was a substantial factor. But we only need one expert to opine on that issue to make it to the jury. And in terms of what issues you need to address if you decide to remand, some of the other issues do not need to be addressed because they won't come up again. The ones that will include the life expectancy chart. To make it simple for you, I'm not asking that you review points of error 4 and 7. Those are the two. 4 and 7 are the two that I can clean up in any retrial. They wouldn't arise in the same way.
Very well. Anything further, Mr. Rankin, at this time? All right. Thank you to both of our attorneys. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne, ke ia aha ho'o kolo kolo kie kie hano hano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.